Miami-Dade County's mayor gets a mandate, and so does public transit. Palm Beach County gets a new elite university, and a former Haitian president gets U.S. sanctions. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the impact of two results from Tuesday's primary election, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava's landslide reelection and landslide approval of a call for expanded Miami-Dade rapid transit. We'll also examine why elite Vanderbilt University is opening an unusual satellite campus in Palm Beach County, and we'll discuss the drug trafficking and gang sponsorship sanctions the U.S. just slapped on former Haitian President Michel Martelly. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Tuesday's Florida primary election didn't produce a lot of surprises in South Florida, but it did result in two unmistakable mandates in Miami-Dade County. The first was Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava's landslide reelection victory. She took almost 60% of the vote compared to less than 25% for her nearest competitor. The second was an almost 80% yes to a straw poll question asking if Miami-Dade should expand its widely criticized public transit, specifically its Metrorail, passenger rail, and Metro Mover. The straw poll was, of course, non-binding, but couple that with the big win for Levine-Cava, who's a transit expansion supporter, and the campaign to upgrade Miami-Dade County's relatively, if not distressingly, threadbare mass transportation suddenly seems to carry a lot more momentum. The question is what Levine-Cava, who's already being talked about as a contender for Florida governor, will do with it, and whether Metro Miami can finally join the public transit ranks of other big U.S. cities. Do you think Tuesday's primary was a shot in the arm for Miami public transit? What should the county do with that mandate? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me here in the studio to discuss this is Kathy Dos Santos. She's executive director of the nonprofit Transit Alliance Miami. Thanks for coming in, Kathy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Doug Hanks, who covers Miami-Dade County for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Always great to have you on, Doug.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
Kathy Dos Santos, let me start with you. I want to play a clip here from Miami-Dade County Commission Chairman Oliver Gilbert, who spearheaded the public transit question on Tuesday's ballot.
We're Miami-Dade County. We're the largest urbanized area in the state of Florida. We are kind of the capital of this part of the hemisphere. But to truly become the world-class community that we say we are, we have to invest in rapid mass transit. You know, I like to point out to folks, if we had built rail, for instance, one corridor, the North Corridor, if we had built it 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the cost was about $300 million. The cost now would be $1.5 billion. It's not going to get cheaper, and congestion is going to get worse.
So, Kathy, remind people what makes Miami-Dade County's public transit so inadequate and why the overwhelming yes vote on mass transit expansion, along with Mayor Levine-Cava's decisive mandate, could now galvanize a more serious commitment to tackling that problem Commissioner Gilbert lays out there.
Absolutely. So South Florida and Miami-Dade specifically has been plagued by this small step approach in terms of our transit system. We, you know, the 21st century short version history of our transit system starts in 2002 with the People's Transportation Plan passing, being supported by voters, and that coming in with a half penny tax. That is largely what we use to fund our transit system, especially the daily operations of our Metrorail, our bus, our Metro Mover, and the trolleys that connect so many people across Miami-Dade. The reality is that from that half penny tax, from when you purchase something to getting that bus, that train in front of your home within a 10-minute walking distance, there has been so much delusion of and really watered down of what the half penny tax can do, because right, there's so many different entities that have a say in how that money is spent, where it's spent. And most importantly, also, there's a lack of vision of how we move forward.
Yes. And not just lack of vision, but would you say also resistance?
absolutely resistance. And politically, that has been one of the strongest challenges that we've had to overcome as an organization that advocates for more investment mm-hmm. and more public transit that is of higher quality. And really this on this lack of understanding that when there's complaints about our existing transit system, that does not mean that folks do not want to see more of it. Complaints is because it truly is not up to par with people's needs. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean, as we saw with the straw ballot poll, that people don't want more of it and that they don't want mass transit rail close to where they live and that takes them where they need to go.
So as I asked before, is what happened this week then a shot in the arm toward remedying that problem that you just laid out?
It definitely is a reminder to our commission, which is largely, you know, the commission that we have been dealing mm-hmm. with for the last 4 years and will most likely remain mostly unchanged coming into the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they have been slowly making moves and we have been planning for so long. And it's really the time to okay. leave behind this snail-like pace and put the energy and the pressure behind our agency okay.
so
to start delivering.
You feel this is a good push then?
I do.
Okay. Doug Hanks, let me ask you the same question. Do you think Tuesday's straw poll vote is a wake-up call for the county and especially the county commission to the fact that people here do want a public transit system that's more in line with the kind of metropolis Miami aspires to be?
Probably not. I think the question said, would you pay higher taxes for more transit? That would be more definitive.
Uh-huh, right.
It was kind of a feel-good question. And I think the results showed that. But it certainly helps for those who would advocate for more spending on transit. I mean, if I look at it as if a majority of the commission wants to devote more dollars to transit, this is a good thing to point to.
Right.
If they don't, there's many things to say about that. Just mm-hmm. kind of like the Pets Trust straw poll, right? Which actually asked, would you raise taxes for more money on animal spending? And the voters said yes, but the commission said no.
Right. Okay. So that dynamic could very well play out as well in this issue, mm-hmm. you think, as well. Yeah. That's a great point.
And can I also point out that, you know, this commission, this mayor came into office with a major transit project in the works, which was the Miami Beach monorail, and killed it. Uh-huh. So that if you're one saying, hey, listen, where's the momentum for more transit? I mean, that project had some issues, but it was in the pipeline.
Right. So let's get into some specifics here. Kathy Dos Santos, as I mentioned, Tuesday's straw poll was focused on expanding metro rail, passenger rail, and the downtown metro mover. What projects do group like Transit Alliance Miami most want to see Mayor Levine Cava and the County Commission move on then, now that they've got this fairly loud message from Miami-Dade voters? In the best case scenario, what would you like to see them move on as a priority?
Well, the really good thing is that, you know, all these years of planning, all these decades of planning really do have some projects, massive projects in the pipelines that align with this shared vision from the public. And a great example of that is the Bay Link Metro Mover Extension, which is a corridor that would connect downtown Miami to South Beach. And yes, there has been some voices from the Miami Beach Commission and South Beach that have stood against the project in the past. They don't actually hold a say in whether this project moves forward. And regardless, the voters through mm-hmm. the straw ballot poll really helped to support and dissuade those concerns. And that is a project that is largely funded and that actually can start breaking ground very soon, I believe, if our elected officials truly actually start applying pressure. Because yes, that's permitting holdups, but the reality is that when we are having a double-decker, massive billion-dollar project of the Sinector Bridge, there's no going to the voters and asking for the money. There's no going to the voters and asking if that should be mm-hmm. done. Right. And yet it happens regardless. So there's political pressure is applied on all sort of projects across mm-hmm. Miami-Dade all the time. And our elected officials really need to start turning it towards transit.
Well, we have Arlene on the line from Miami, and I get the feeling, Arlene, that you voted yes as well for this straw poll question. You think expanding mass transit in Miami-Dade is a, quote, great idea. Welcome to the South Florida, Arlene. Why did you vote yes?
I think it would increase the walkability of the community. You have a lot of people that have moved here from places like New York. That's very heavy on public transportation. It will go along with the increased home values. The taxes are going to go up regardless.
So you...
Why not?
That's interesting that you think that this sort of thing would raise property values as well, that it would enhance the city economically in that regard. That's interesting. Doug Hanks, what do you think the mayor and the commission can and will most realistically move on when it comes to public transit in the wake of this straw poll message? I mean, last year on the show, you and I talked about some important projects coming online, like passenger rail along the Dolphin Expressway and down to Homestead using existing freight lines. So I would also imagine that there are voices on the commission saying, look, we've already been pushing the SMART plan forward, meaning the Strategic Miami Area Rapid Transit Program, and we've already got expansion projects like bus rapid transit online. We didn't need Commissioner Gilbert's straw poll to get us moving on this issue. Are they right, Doug, or does this straw poll remind them of what more the SMART plan needs to do?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's two big things happening over the next 12 months and maybe sooner. One is this, what's called the Coastal Link, which is commuter rail parallel to the Brightline tracks. That's actually very real and coming close to getting approved.
And there was some big news this week regarding that as well, right?
Right. I mean, the really big factor is the Biden administration has approved
exactly, yeah,
I think $400 million or something like some large amount of money, and Florida's approved half of that. And so with those dollars, the conventional thinking is that can get done. So someone will be able to pull the trigger on that, assuming it goes through the process in D.C. So that actually is something that's probably going to be the next smart corridor line that will be moving towards a green light. I mean, a long way from construction, but moving towards. Now, the other one is the one and only smart plan corridor that's actually under construction and almost finished is a rapid transit bus in South Dade.
Yep.
And that's going to, for the first time, you're actually going to be able to have county electeds, assuming all goes well, cutting ribbons, riding on things will be happening beyond PowerPoint presentations at the county commission chambers. Mm-hmm. And if it goes well, if it meets or beats expectations, I think that could create significant momentum to, okay, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's not well received or doesn't seem to be much of an improvement, that's right. A different story.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Kathy Dos Santos of Transit Alliance Miami and Doug Hanks of the Miami Herald about the landslide wins in Tuesday's primary for Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava and for the question of expanding Miami-Dade's public transit and what they may mean together. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Kathy Dos Santos, another big ticket item on the wish list of folks like Commissioner Gilbert is a new metro rail line going up Northwest 27th Avenue up to the Hard Rock Casino Complex, correct? Why is that a priority? And frankly, a lot of folks down where I live in South Dade would love to know if we can expand metro rail into North Miami-Dade, why is expansion of metro rail in South Miami-Dade still a dead issue?
And that's a very understandable question. The reality is that there's many things that go into play as to what makes a transit corridor, a mass rapid transit corridor, attractive and feasible in terms of political will and even just financially. Oftentimes, density, the accessibility of the in terms of is there enough space to construct, and will there be enough demand? Usually demand and density mm-hmm. will dry it together.
Mm-hmm.
The South Dade corridor definitely had the space for it, but there were always a lot of questions about the demand from that particular corridor.
Mm-hmm.
On the North corridor, which is this connection from 27th Avenue going up to the Hard Rock Stadium, that corridor does already have strong demand on their transit that is in the area, which is the Better Bus Network routes that currently service up and down on parallel roads. You have the 22nd bus route, the 22, the 27, and a few other that this corridor, this North corridor, would definitely support mm-hmm. that flow of people. And it's the reality that there has been some openness to upzoning a lot in that area and really driving density into there. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also the reality that there's political opinions that are driving, you know, what becomes a rapid, a mass transit system that is rail as opposed to BRT.
Okay, no, that's a good explanation. Thank you. Now, Doug Hanks, the other focus in the straw poll vote, of course, was expansion of the downtown Metro Mover, especially its extension across Biscayne Bay to Miami Beach. Do you think Tuesday's result gives that any new impetus?
I think maybe incrementally, but... You know, that corridor has a unique position in this debate in that there was a project that the county paid millions of dollars towards, and then it was canceled by the current mayor and essentially the current county commission that they didn't stop her from blocking it, right?
Uh-huh.
So I think that's a fairly discouraging development. So we'll see what happens next, right? But there were problems on that corridor, and obviously a lot of opposition from Miami Beach, et cetera, et cetera. So now the person behind this referendum, Chairman Gilbert, is a huge advocate for the North Corridor.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which, you know, so I think that's really, that's where I would be looking for momentum.
All right. On the line, we also have John now with a sort of contrarian view here. He believes that it's a waste to spend more money on the system, which he feels is already underused. I would imagine he's probably talking about Metro Rail. John from Kendall, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Why do you feel that way?
Well, I've been watching this for years, and I still don't see how the Metro Rail is being used to a maximum extent. I think it's being underused if you look at the statistics. And the same thing I believe is true with the bus lines. Lanes that were created from Dadeland down into South Dade. And now, on top of that, I see spending of $300 million to build 13 basically covers for elaborate bus benches along this bus lane. Now, that's an average of $20-plus million for each structure, which only... give an overhead structure and people waiting to get on and off the bus.
Right. So the economics don't make sense to you there, John. I understand. Finally here, before we leave, Kathy DeSantos and Doug, I wanted to ask you both real quickly. As we mentioned, Mayor Levine Cava got a real re-election mandate this week. And Kathy, I wanted to ask you, do you think that she did enough in her first term to push rapid transit expansion? And do you think that she'll get even more serious and assertive about it now that she's won re-election so convincingly?
I think that she went in having a good project that she had backed from the beginning as a commissioner, which was the Better Bus Network, and saw it through implementation.
Mm-hmm.
That being said,
all right,
there was still much more that could have been pushed further. We could have had groundbreakings of projects started that are rail that mm-hmm. we had every indication to know that they would be popular, and that wasn't seen through yet. So I really hope mm-hmm. that this mandate is something that helps drive that.
And Doug Hanks, speaking of Mayor Levine Cava, you wrote an interesting piece after Tuesday's election about whether she'll be considered a contender now to run for governor of Florida in 2026, given that, you know, profile she's got now. Do you think that gives her even more leverage to tackle public transit expansion here?
Well, I guess the conventional wisdom is if you've been reelected and you're not running again, you're going to make bolder decisions and spend political capital. If you want to win another election, maybe be a little bit more conservative. So that's where I would leave that.
Okay. Doug Hanks covers Miami-Dade County for the Miami Herald. Kathy Dos Santos is Executive Director of Transit Alliance Miami. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's common for public universities to open up satellite campuses inside their states, but in the past decade, a new trend has emerged. Private colleges are setting up satellite campuses in other parts of the country. Boston's Northeastern University, for example, has one in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now Florida is set to become a site for that 21st century collegiate expansion. Vanderbilt University, an elite private school in Nashville, Tennessee, plans to open a graduate business campus in West Palm Beach. What's interesting is that it will be built on the same spot the public University of Florida wanted to open a satellite campus on before that effort fell through 2 years ago. But given the relatively small presence of private higher education in Florida, top-ranked Vanderbilt's project is a significant deal for South Florida and a potential financial boon as well. Vanderbilt claims the 300,000-square-foot downtown West Palm Beach campus will generate more than $7 billion in economic activity in the next 25 years. What do you see as the impact of Vanderbilt's unusual plans for Palm Beach County and the rest of Florida? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Wayne Washington of the Palm Beach Post, who's been covering the Vanderbilt proposal. And we're also hoping to have with us Kelly Smallridge, president of Palm Beach County's Business Development Board. So, Wayne, while we're waiting for Kelly here, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And let me start by asking you to remind us why the University of Florida plan to open a satellite campus in West Palm Beach fell through.
That plan was contingent, as the Vanderbilt plan is, on land donations from both Palm Beach County and West Palm Beach. But the UF plan also was dependent on property from Jeff Green, a billionaire developer who owns lots of land and lots of land in West Palm Beach. There was a naming rights dispute between Jeff Green and the University of Florida, and that was the source of that deal unraveling.
Okay. All right. That's a good reminder. Now, Kelly Smallridge, I understand we've got you on now. Thanks for coming on to you as well.
Absolutely. Good afternoon.
Now, you have described that implosion, let's say, of the University of Florida plan to open up a satellite campus in West Palm Beach, quote, probably the greatest economic development loss you've seen in your 30-plus career. Now comes Vanderbilt University wanting to do the same thing there. And I wanted to ask you, why Vanderbilt University and why West Palm Beach? I think a lot of folks would ask, what's the mutual attraction there?
So as you know, Palm Beach County and West Palm Beach have gone through a major transformation of our economy since COVID. And the value that a university like Vanderbilt brings us is really the preparation of a highly skilled workforce, which is required for the new industries of the future that we're bringing in, including the fintech companies and the movement and growth of Wall Street South, as well as healthcare sciences and healthcare technology, artificial intelligence, and data analytics.
Right. I hear that term a lot, Wall Street South, these days. You feel that Palm Beach and Palm Beach County is sort of leading that mission?
Yes, absolutely. With over 250 financial service, hedge funds, private equity, asset managers relocating from other parts of the United States, I do believe that Palm Beach County is definitely leading that initiative. And the Business Development Board is in the process and very close to even trademarking Wall Street South.
Right.
And
Vanderbilt and West Palm Beach thought that all of that made this a good marriage then.
Absolutely. I think that the collaboration of universities is what provides that highly skilled workforce, and companies move to areas where they'll find high skilled talent.
Right. Now, Wayne, the West Palm Beach City Commission voted unanimously this week to donate $12.8 million worth of city land to Vanderbilt for this project. What is it going to entail?
Well, the city wants to partner with the county and with Vanderbilt to basically donate this land. Of course, the city is trying to make sure that it's not simply a giveaway. They've crafted the donation deal to include assurances that Vanderbilt would use the property for campus purposes and for purposes that support a campus.
Right.
Construction would have to commence within 5 years of the deal being struck. And so West Palm Beach feels that it has some protections to make sure that it doesn't give up valuable land downtown that another business or university could just flip and make money on. That would certainly be an affront to West Palm Beach's taxpayers.
Right. And again, this is going to be a graduate business school, for all intents and purposes, an MBA program, let's say. And this will involve about how many students and how many faculty?
Well, it's going to double the size of Vanderbilt's graduate program, a business program.
Right. It was interesting in your article. The chancellor there said this is not just a satellite campus; it's a quote second campus.
Yes, 100 to 125 faculty members, 1,000 students, and so certainly a footprint like that in West Palm Beach. City officials believe that's a real win for them. You could imagine. Campus, you could imagine students and faculty members studying, working, perhaps living in West Palm Beach. You can imagine the spinoff benefits from that for businesses that
right.
serve that group of folks. So that's certainly a win for West Palm Beach in the eyes of
right.
city.
Now, Kelly Smallwood, speaking of those spinoff benefits that Wayne was just talking about, what then do Vanderbilt and the Business Development Board foresee this new campus bringing to West Palm Beach and Palm Beach County in terms of economic dividends, jobs created, that sort of thing?
So there are two areas that we see in addition to the economic impact of just having the sheer campus in West Palm Beach. Universities are often incubators for new businesses, and we get inquiries from very high-tech companies in artificial intelligence and life science, and they plan on creating an innovation center there where they can spin off and commercialize technologies. This is also going to be a research innovation and, of course, research and development leading to the creation of new technologies and businesses. Being able to send entrepreneurs over there is additional benefit. And then as part of our sales pitch for selling and promoting Palm Beach County, usually companies ask, draw a five-mile radius around the area where I want to locate my technology company or corporate headquarters or fintech company and tell me the number of graduates that are coming out of area universities. And so that's another way to commercialize and see a greater economic impact for having another university complementary to the seven that we already have in Palm Beach County.
Mm-hmm.
So we expect that this will serve a great role in the attraction of new companies and also be an opportunity for small businesses to participate in their innovation center and tech hub.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Palm Beach Post's Wayne Washington about Vanderbilt University's unusual plans to build a big satellite campus in Palm Beach County. And also with us is Kelly Smallridge. She is the president of the Business Development Board of Palm Beach County. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Wayne Washington, I know Vanderbilt's Vice Chancellor Nathan Green, who I just mentioned before, told you that he's certain this Vanderbilt graduate business campus will be, quote, a wonderful additive to the community up there. Now, aside from all the economic benefits we've discussed, what do you as a journalist there think he might be right about in terms of how this will be a, quote, wonderful additive to the societal life of West Palm Beach and Palm Beach County?
Well, one of the things West Palm Beach and other cities want is they want youth. They want young talent. They want young, upwardly mobile people living and thriving in their community. And a lot of times when young folks go to a university, they tend to stick around once they've gotten their training, once they complete their education.
Right. Great point.
Stick around, work, find work, start their families. And West Palm Beach would have a leg up on retaining some of those graduates, and that would be a big benefit to the city.
All right. Kelly Smallridge, I also wanted to ask you about the aspect of that, what we were kind of hinting at before, this government-university-economy triangle we so often hear about relating to projects like this. I mean, some of the more famous, you know, in the United States, being the triangle up in North Carolina, or you know, the University of Texas triangle in Austin, or Stanford and Silicon Valley out in California. Obviously, this is a little smaller than that. But as I mentioned, aside from the University of Miami, private higher education does not have a significant presence in Florida compared to other states. U.S. News and World Report ranks Vanderbilt number 18 among national universities in this country. And that's a pretty attractive cachet, obviously. So how does having what is essentially a Vanderbilt MBA program sitting in downtown West Palm Beach help Palm Beach County become a magnet for more elite companies, more, and not just more elite companies, but more elite culture, for example, and all the things that you know, sort of become attracted as a result of a project like this?
And I think you definitely gave the right perception of where Vanderbilt is as an elite university. And there is a certain cachet that comes with the top 20 or top 50, and they fall in a category that is unlike a lot of others in our southeastern region. So naturally, companies are reading the news right now and are inquiring about, you know, this, when will it happen? What is the scope? How can we start positioning to come into your county and explore the opportunity of bringing in more employees and a greater footprint to the area? So I think that when you know, there are universities and then there are really elite universities, and that's going to continue to attract a level of companies at a higher sophistication in technology and AI that we don't see on a regular basis.
And Kelly, one thing I don't think we've really touched on enough here is we've been talking a lot about West Palm Beach and Palm Beach County get out of this. But what is, tell us a little bit more about what you think a university like Vanderbilt, going back to the example I gave in my intro, what does a Northeastern university, for example, get out of setting up a campus in Charlotte, North Carolina? Or what does a college in Boston get by setting up a satellite campus in Los Angeles, as in the case of Emerson College, for example? What do you think Vanderbilt really is getting out of this by setting up a satellite campus so far away from its own home?
So I think yesterday at a forum, Vanderbilt made it very clear that they saw an opportunity in Florida, in Palm Beach County specifically, because of the growth that we've had in a number of areas. They noted the Wall Street South fintech growth, they noted healthcare service growth, and they noted the population growth. They also realized that Palm Beach County has gone from an economy that was one built on agriculture, real estate, and construction and service jobs, to now one built on fintech, healthcare, and corporate headquarters. And so that shift in the movement of now 59 billionaires and 71,000 millionaires with a strong Vanderbilt alumni population already in Palm Beach County, as well as the gateway to Latin and Caribbean markets, they saw this as a way to expand their footprint into an area that is on the cusp of magnificent growth,
right,
into futuristic technology.
And finally, Wayne Washington, along the lines of what Kelly was just talking about there, I wanted to get your sense of what do people just on the ground there in Palm Beach County, do they feel that this is going to have that effect that Kelly was just talking about, of raising Palm Beach County, and for that matter, the rest of South Florida, out of its low-wage economy mindset? Do you think that it will have that impact, or do people up there feel that it will have that impact?
Certainly, there is excitement about this, but there's concern, too. You know, there hasn't been a lot of outreach to the public to explain exactly why the city is pursuing this. I do believe residents know that this is a potential benefit, but there are devil, you know, in the detail type stuff to kind of work through.
Sure.
And the city is going to have another meeting next month, and they could finalize their plans to donate this land. But people believe that West Palm Beach is on the upswing and believe that this deal could be a beneficial move for the city.
Lots to watch for here. Wayne Washington is a reporter for the Palm Beach Post, and Kelly Smallridge is president of Palm Beach County's Business Development Board. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Most Haitians and people who watch Haiti already knew that former President Michel Martelly was considered one of the most corrupt heads of state that impoverished country ever had. Martelly, a former carnival singer known as Sweet Mickey, took office a year after Haiti's cataclysmic 2010 earthquake. During his presidency from 2011 to 2016, he presided over a raft of astonishing scandals, including the embezzlement of $2 billion from an oil aid fund. But now the U.S., belatedly, say critics, has put Martelly in an even more sinister light. This week, it sanctioned him for his alleged involvement in Haitian drug trafficking and for allegedly sponsoring the powerful, violent gangs that are now the de facto rulers of much of the country. The U.S., in effect, accuses Martelly of laying the foundation for the terror that has made Haiti a failed state today. Many Haitians and Haitian Americans here say Martelly, who resides in Miami, should, as a result, face U.S. criminal charges, too. Do you agree? What are your feelings about Martelly's legacy in Haiti and the U.S. sanctions he now faces? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Gypsy Metellus. She's a South Florida Haitian American community leader and executive director of the nonprofit Saint-Lach Haitian Neighborhood Center in North Miami. How are you, Gypsy?
I'm well, Tim. Thank you so much for the invitation. How are you?
I'm doing okay, thanks.
Good.
One of the big reasons I wanted to have you on the program, Gypsy, today is that I recall an interview you and I did 3 years ago about the crisis in Haiti, and you shared this with me.
The Haitian government is non-existent. What's happening in Haiti is a widespread gang takeover of the country. I was just in Haiti. There was gunshots in my neighborhood every night.
I'm most struck by your observation of a, quote, gang takeover of Haiti, which, of course, has virtually come true there. But is the U.S. simply confirming now what you and I and practically everyone else knew, that former Haitian President Michel Martelly helped make those gangs powerful enough to take over the country today?
Let me tell you, Tim, the conversations, not just in the Saint-Lach lobby, but among Haitian Americans in South Florida, and I'm sure throughout the diaspora, is, let me tell you, this was about time, because this is, as you indicated, this is what's been known by everyone in Haiti and outside of Haiti as well, right? So for us, it was about time, right? Yeah. The U.S. should have followed Canada's example,
right,
in 2022.
Two years ago, they levied the same sanctions against him. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I believe that Michel Martelly ought to be held accountable for the violence that he's unleashed on in Haiti through his sponsoring of gangs, leadership of gangs, the resulting famine that Haitians are experiencing, the displacement of so many Haitian individuals, and the fact that the country's been drained of so many folks who are yearning to breathe free,
right,
yearning to just be in a safe environment, and as a result are coming to the United States or going elsewhere where they can have safe haven. And yes, you mentioned the embezzlement of the Petrocaribe funds.
Yeah.
Again, was a countrywide, if not worldwide, conversation many, many years ago.
Sure.
And it was documented that, again, the Martelly government, prime minister, senators, and so many of their associates were involved in the embezzlement of those funds.
Yeah, now talking about that political elite, now, of course, Michel Martelly is hardly the only figure among Haiti's political elite known for sponsoring the gangs there. In fact, Haitian-American Congresswoman Sheila Sherfalus McCormick, for example, who represents South Florida, has sponsored legislation to impose stiffer penalties on Haitian leaders who use the gangs as their street enforcers, as it were. But do you and the Haitian-American community leadership here feel the U.S. is being tough enough then, not just on Martelly, but on all those other Haitian political leaders involved in much the same thing he's being accused of this week?
So, you know, I think we are a little bit disappointed that, you know, these sanctions came 2 years, it was 2 years in the making based on, again, the excellent reporting of the Miami Herald, right? Conversations were being held internally, whether with DEA based on their Inspector General report, or if not Inspector General, Special Counsel, if you will. In addition to that, of course, the State Department was weighing the consequences for both Haiti and for the U.S. if they took this action. Well, you know, a large segment of the community is saying that the U.S. is finally taking some responsibility,
right?
Now, having had a hand in the creation of Martelly to begin with.
I want to play another clip here from a Haitian American attorney in Miramar, Marcel Denis, who recently led a lawsuit that accused Michel Martelly of embezzling millions of dollars of fees from expat cell phone calls into Haiti that were supposed to be used for improving education in the country. Here's what Denise told me this week in response to the news about the U.S. sanctioning Martelly.
The U.S. have known for the longest now that Martelly was at the center of gang activities in Haiti, given what has been done to Haiti. What the Haitian people are really looking for is some actions behind the accusation.
Now, by some action behind the accusation, Mr. Denis meant actual U.S. criminal charges against Martelly, not just financial sanctions. Do you and other Haitian American community leaders here, Gypsy, feel the U.S. should go further and criminally indict Michel Martelly for his alleged involvement in drug trafficking and gang sponsorship?
That's right. Absolutely. I think that that is the expectation of most Haitians, because that's been the example that the U.S. has set across the, especially in this hemisphere, right? And so he needs to be held accountable. And if that means facing legal charges in addition to the financial and hopefully the social consequences that he needs to face, he and his associates need to understand that they should never have a role, any role whatsoever, and Haitian social, economic, and political life, right? And these sanctions and the additional actions that we're hoping for example, you know, global sanctions from other countries, right?
Right.
These sanctions will tell the folks who are misbehaving in Haiti, whether it's politicians, whether it's business leaders who are using these gangs to advance their personal interests.
Right.
Well, these folks need to know that, you know, the clock is ticking. Time is running out for them,
right,
too, and that actions will be taken such that we can eradicate this kind of behavior from Haiti once and for all. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, give the Haitian people a sense that we can reclaim this country. We can rebuild this country based on norms of governance and accountability and rule of law and opportunities for Haitian people, hardworking Haitian people.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Gypsy Metellus about the sanctions the U.S. slapped on former Haitian President Michel Martelly this week and the ultra-corrupt legacy he allegedly left in Haiti. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We have Tony on the line here from Miami. And Tony, it looks that as though you agree with the U.S. sanctioning former President Martelly. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, and Gypsy and everybody at the station. Absolutely, Sweet Mickey needs to be behind bars. In order to have a reprieve from the gang in Haiti, Sweet Mickey needs to be behind bars. Remember Stanley Schweiger, when Stanley Schweiger was the spokesperson for the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince, he said directly under Miami Herald that he hired Sweet Mickey to put Sweet Mickey in the most dreaded terrorist organization in Haiti called FRAP. And Sweet Mickey used to work for Michel Francois, a drug dealer. He used to work for Raoul Cedras, another drug dealer. And that's what he's been doing, selling drugs and corrupt every single
I need to remind people the Sweet Mickey nickname you just used, that's the nickname of former President Michel Martelly.
That's his gang name. That's his gang name. Everybody knows under this name. So I think it's about time that the U.S. do something with Sweet Mickey. That is every night spending the money, Haitian money every night.
Right.
That's what he's been doing.
Well, Tony,
it's about time for him to be behind bars. Another 203 from the gang, Sweet Nicky needs to be behind bars, and now he needs to be behind bars immediately.
Well, Tony, thanks very much for your call. Now, Jepsy, I should say WLRN did attempt to reach former President Michel Martelly for comment this week, but we were unsuccessful, and I have not seen any response on his part yet to the U.S. sanctions. Have you?
No.
Okay. But earlier this year, a Haitian judge issued an arrest warrant for Martelly for the alleged corruption he committed as president. And that's obviously one of the reasons Martelly chooses to live here in Miami these days. How does it make the Haitian diaspora here feel knowing that he's living here comfortably, safe from justice back in Haiti? Do you feel that, part of the U.S. sanctions should be, let's say, Martelly's deportation back to Haiti to face those charges against him?
Well, that's a wonderful idea, and that's precisely what needs to happen, because while he is living in the United States as a legal permanent resident, right, who has committed a number of crimes which the U.S. has now documented. So just as we are deporting very innocent people back to the situation that Martelly created, he needs to also face the same music, right?
And talking about...
While the rest of us are completely afraid of going to Haiti because of a situation that he has helped to create.
And talking about that situation he allegedly helped create, Jepsy, I want to pivot here to that current situation in Haiti. As we've been discussing, the violent and powerful gangs that former President Michel Martelly allegedly sponsored in Haiti have all but taken over the country in recent years. Last month, a UN-sponsored, US-funded multinational security assistance mission led by Kenyan police forces finally started arriving in Haiti to help the national police there confront and perhaps subdue those gangs. But so far, that mission is having trouble. What's your reading from here about how that whole effort is going?
Oh, mine. I don't have any better reading than what we are, what the Miami Herald is reporting to us, right? We are concerned that while on the one hand, the Haitian National Police needs this support, we want to be sure that, in fact, they will get the training, the skills, the expertise that they need to fight these gangs, but that also this Kenyan force needs to be held accountable to not do anything that they shouldn't do, to not violate any Haitian person's civil rights, to not abuse anyone, male, female, or otherwise. Yeah. And to not do any of those other things that we've experienced with this international mission.
Jepsy, for time, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Jepsy Metellus is executive director of the Saint-La Haitian Neighborhood Center in North Miami. Jepsy, many thanks.
Thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup. Bad Mango. No, that's not a new South Florida detective series streaming on Netflix. It's what a lot of us have been murmuring to ourselves this summer when we step outside and look at our beloved mango trees, because the fruit has largely been a big disappointment this year. Labor Day is just a week away, for example, and I usually like to take all the mangoes I haven't eaten yet and make mango daiquiris that weekend. But this year, no can do. I barely had enough to get me through breakfast in July. And I'm hardly the only one affected. Chef Niven Patel of the Ghee Indian Kitchen restaurant in Kendall is feeling it too.
We have like a 7-foot freezer. It's just for mangoes. So we can serve our mangoes throughout the year. You know, it usually lasts at least like 7-8 months after mango season is over. And like this year, we haven't been able to freeze anything. We didn't have any surplus. Just enough to kind of serve the restaurant like right now. It kind of changes how we look at the menu.
So what stunted our mango bounty this year? University of Florida tropical fruit expert Jonathan Crane tells us that cold snaps we had earlier in the year kept a lot of mango seed embryos from developing. I get it, but it still doesn't bring back my mango daiquiri. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.